And as you're being situated, if you would join me in turning to the book of Hosea. Three prophets would have been acquainted with each other and would have been preaching at the same time in the northern two-thirds of the nation of Israel, the geographic area of Israel. It's a rather small area. I mean, it gets a lot of attention in news, but I'll remind you again that Israel is one-seventh the size of Illinois. So if you can imagine Illinois sliced into seven sections, and Israel is equal to one of those sections. So it's a relatively small geographic area. And the northern two-thirds of that was called Israel, and the bottom third was called Judah. So Judah was around Jerusalem and south of Jerusalem and just a little bit north. But then from what we commonly think of as Samaria, north was called Israel. It was divided into two parts after Solomon because Israel had sinned against the Lord. His sons were fighting over who would get control. And so the kingdom became divided. And so from this time on, Israel would be divided between Israel and Judah. This period of time, the three preachers that would have preached together would have been Hosea, Amos, and Jonah. So they all would have known each other. We're not talking about that larger geographic area. It's not like they might have heard about one another in some gossipy way that, you know, there's a prophet and he lives over by the Mediterranean Sea and there's one that lives over by the Jordan River, and they didn't know each other. They did know each other, and they might not have been close friends, but at least they would have been aware of each other and would have seen each other, talked to each other, because the community of prophets all knew one another. And that was true from the time of Elijah forward. And so these three would have prophesied together. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to take up Hosea. Hosea was the longest lived of the three. So Amos, who was a farmer, and Jonah, who was a fleer, and Hosea were all together, but Amos and Jonah were just about done, not quite, a decade or so. And then Hosea came along, and he preached for quite a period of time before the larger prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and some of those. So these are some of the earliest ones in time period. The time period is around 750 B.C., so they call it the 8th century before Christ, about 750. At 722, which is just going to be about 30 years from the time that Hosea was preaching, God is going to raise up the Assyrian nation, bring their army in, and capture all of the area from Jerusalem north and take them into captivity, lock, stock, and barrel. They're all gone because of their sin against the Lord. And it was grievous. Because the society was agrarian in its lifestyle and its livelihood, the people of Israel began to believe that they needed to appease the gods of the weather, the gods of the soil, not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so they turned away from God. Actually, the word that is used to describe what they did is to turn and stand away from. They actually walked away from the Lord. And in place of the worship of the Lord, which they went through the formalities of it, God says of them, "Your lips draw near me, but your hearts are far from me." They went through the formalities of it, but they really didn't have a heart for the Lord. They turned to Baal and Ashtoreth. Now, you've heard those words before. The Moloch was another. The worship of those idols was just sordid, and it's not something you could really talk about in public, and certainly not in a mixed group. It was ruthless. If you can imagine, abortion doesn't even get close to the worship of Baal. It was really bad. In order to accommodate what they believed would appease the gods of the weather so their crops would be good and their herds would be healthy, they would come to a temple where there were both male and female prostitutes. They would have children through those prostitutes, only to publicly kill their children in awful ways. This is the depth to which God's people had declined. God said through Ezekiel in three places later, I think it's chapter 11, chapter 36, and chapter 44, that God wanted to take away their heart of stone. They had become hard-hearted toward the Lord. It didn't happen all at once. It took years, decades, for it to develop. But as they turned away from the Lord, their heart began to be hardened toward the Lord, such that it became like stone. They could not bring themselves to worship God in an authentic, genuine way. Everything was formal. Everything was geared to make them feel like they were worshiping God when they really weren't. We don't know a lot about their church services. We don't know a lot about the way they sang. We don't know a lot about their rituals, their recitations. But be it sufficient to say their hearts were like stone toward God. And as a result of that, God's anger came on his people. Now, God said when he was prophesying through Hosea to Israel that his judgment was coming, he warned Judah not to follow Israel into sin. Don't do the things that Israel was doing. But there was going to be not only a cumulative effect of sin in Israel, but it was going to flow over and have a contaminating effect on Judah. And indeed, that happened. And so by the 6th century B.C., God raised up the Babylonians to take Judah into captivity. So the entire land was taken into captivity. And so when we read Hosea, we read a lot about how angry God was with his people. Now, God can be angry in a perfect way. We normally, when we get angry, have a sort of a vengeance about us. I'm going to get even, or I wish I could get even. And we have these little, at least I do, and maybe I'm atypical in this, but I can have little conversations in my brain and think, boy, if I could have that conversation back, I would have said that. And if I would have said that, then they wouldn't have anything to say back to me because I would have got the last word in first. So you play that little game in your mind. So my anger has a tendency to be vengeful. That would be considered vengeful, as well as bitter. But God isn't like that. God has the capacity to be angry on purpose in a perfect way. And so as his people, if you can imagine, God would create a child and then watch his people come to worship to kill their baby. How angry that must have made him. You can say frustrated. I just can't imagine that God was able to tolerate that and not just annihilate them all. But God is not like that. He doesn't have to get even with anybody in order to rest, W-R-E-S-T, rest his anger. He doesn't have to hurt somebody so that he feels better. God has what the Bible calls everlasting love. And if we had to have a theme verse for Hosea that's not in Hosea, we would choose Psalm 118, verse 1. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His love endures forever. And that's not just in word. That's the way God behaves Himself. And so if you can think of the deepest, darkest secrets that anybody could keep as a Christian, God's love is deeper than that. And though God becomes angry and He allows the consequences of our choices to catch up to us, He doesn't treat us like our sins deserve. He has everlasting love for us. And it is an amazing reality. I was just, as we were going through some of the reading, and I was listening to John and listening to the songs, I was just thinking about in my life how God expresses this everlasting love. And I thought of a couple people that were in my high school. Way back then, I would, you notice people. You notice what they do. And sometimes you pay attention to sports figures. And we didn't play football or anything like that. Basketball was our only sport. And so you remembered some of those players. But there were people that you just remembered. We had some crude people in our high school. You know, we were farmers. And, you can get a little crude at times. But, I mean, we had some nasty people in my high school. But as I sat there and thought, who would be the nastiest people I can think of? And there was one cheerleader we had. And she was a senior. I was a freshman. I only knew much of her through my sister. But she was known for doing back walkovers in a dress so that all the boys could see the color of underwear she was wearing for the day. She's now a missionary wife overseas. It's an amazing reality. One guy that I played ball with, you talk about somebody that had a crude mouth. I've been in service. I didn't know anybody that could swear as much as, I won't use his name, could. Oh, he was awful. He thought up words that I didn't know existed and would freely use them. Just a dirty, dirty mouth on that boy. I went to service. I came home. We met in town, just happened to pass each other on the street. And I said hi, and he said hi. And he said, oh, by the way, I wonder if we can get together. I'd like to ask you some questions about the Bible, and we can study some verses together. I said, are you kidding me? What happened to you? The answer was, Jesus happened to me. You see, God's love, although we sometimes attach it to a building where people are meeting together and they're good people, they don't do things that are terribly bad, that's not true. We've all done things terribly bad. And throughout our lifetime, throughout my parents' lifetime, my grandparents' lifetime, or my great-grandparents' life, you go back as far as you want to, God has been loving people with an everlasting love, and not holding their sins against them, or repaying them according to iniquity, but inviting them home if they would like to come. And it's amazing reality that we sit today here singing songs to the one who does that. Genuine change, genuine forgiveness, and hope for change. I'm sure both of those people that I mentioned would love to have that period of time back, to be able to erase some things that they did, said, did to others, and change the way they were. But they can't. All that could be done for them is the same thing God does with anyone. He'll come into our life and change our heart from darkness to light. That takes a while. Sometimes it's immediate, like Brother Todd's testimony. It just happens just like that. But sometimes it's a long, hard slug getting over some things that God wants to clean up. I've even heard some say at the end of their life, I wasn't quite able to get that overcome. But God is still loving them and still not holding their sin against them or repaying them according to their iniquity. And Hosea is not only the literary, but the particular illustration of God's everlasting love. And that's what the whole book is about. It's not about a prophet doing something awful and marrying a prostitute. She wasn't when they started. The Hebrew words indicate she was not a prostitute at the time, but fell into that sin after they were married. The first child that they had in the first chapter, you'll notice it says, he had a child with her. That's Hosea. After that, it only says, she had a child. It was with someone else. And yet, after all of that, we find by the end of the book that God was drawing even her back to salvation. So as we sit here, there's always hope that those things that embarrass us, that cause us so much guilt, that we wish, oh, I wish I could have had that over, wish I could have done that. That's not what's important. What's important is it can be covered by the blood of Christ. And that doesn't give us license to go out and do whatever we want to. God wants us to walk with Him and to share in His life. And He will, through the Lord Jesus, forgive us of those things we've done. But He will also give us the gift of His Spirit to help us grow in the things that are important to Him, if we're willing. And so that's what Hosea is about. Do you know anyone in your life who needs forgiveness? Do you need it? Do you need His everlasting love? Then Hosea is for us, as well as for Israel in the Old Testament. For what God did through the sacrificial system in the Old Testament to postpone His punishments. In Jesus, God has taken away sin and taken care of the wrath of God forever and set us free. And so we can sit here as free people today to read these words. We're not going to read the entire book, but I do want to point out a couple of places that are important, I believe. One is in chapter 5. And let's read with... begin reading with verse number 3 of chapter 5 of Hosea. I know Ephraim, that's another word for Israel. And Israel is not hidden from me. For now, O Ephraim, you have played the whore. Israel is defiled. Notice the captivity. Their deeds do not permit them to return to their God. For the spirit of whoredom is within them, and they do not know God. They do not know the Lord. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Israel and Ephraim shall stumble in his guilt. Judah also shall stumble with them. With their flocks and herds they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn from them. They have dealt faithlessly with the Lord, for they have borne alien children. Now the new moon shall devour them with their fields. Blow the horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah. Sound the alarm at Beth-Aven. We follow you, O Benjamin. Ephraim shall become a desolation in the day of punishment among the tribes of Israel. I make known what is sure. The princes of Judah have become like those who move the landmark. Upon them I will pour out my wrath like water. Ephraim is oppressed, crushed in judgment, because he was determined to go after filth. But I am like a moth to Ephraim, and like dry rot to the house of Judah. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to the great king. But he was not able to cure you or heal your wound. For I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear and go away. I will carry off and no one shall rescue. I will return again to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face and in their distress earnestly seek me. Now go over to chapter 14. Beginning with verse 1. Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take with you words. Return to the Lord and say to him, take away all iniquity, accept what is good, and we will pay with bulls and vows of our lips. Assyria shall not save us, but we will ride on horses and we will say no more, our God, to the work of our hands. In you the orphans find mercy. So they're going to say goodbye to their idols. God says, I will heal their apostasy, their standing away from me. I will love them freely. For my anger has turned from them. And I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall blossom like the lily. He shall take up root like the trees of Lebanon. His shoots shall spread out. His beauty shall be like the olive, and his fragrance like Lebanon. They shall return and dwell beneath my shadow, and they will flourish like the grain. They shall blossom like the vine. Their fame should be like the wine of Lebanon. O Ephraim, what have I to do with idols? It is I who answer and look after you. I am like an evergreen cypress. From me comes your fruit. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them. But transgressors stumble in them. And so God is promising his everlasting love to those who would like to receive it. Now, when we look at this book, we're going to look at three things. First of all, through Hosea, God uses a variety of metaphors to describe Israel's rejection of him. And we're going to look at that this morning. We're also going to look at how God details Israel's vulnerabilities that was caused by her own unfaithfulness. We make ourselves vulnerable to guilt and sin and death because of our decisions. We'll look at those specifically. And finally, God will describe his vital deliverance of Israel from snares that she herself caused. But this morning we're simply going to look at the metaphors that God uses to depict Israel's rejection of him. Now the reason I want to do this is when we look at the metaphors that God uses, we will be able to detect how hardness of heart occurs. You can sing songs to God all you want to. You can even read the Bible every day. And your heart can be as cold to God as someone lying in a cemetery. Words don't change anything. The old saying is this: a person will not consistently, walk in a way inconsistent with what they believe. We will do what we believe. We will not always do what we say. So our words can be confusing to people. But when you watch their conduct, you will see what they really believe. And so when we look at the conduct of Israel, we can see what they were saying to God. And in those metaphors, get a hint of how our hearts can become cold toward the Lord and as hard as stone, just like them. Israel was conducting herself like these things. A promiscuous wife. This is one who is married, but she goes to be with other men. She conducted herself like an indifferent mother. You've already heard stories of children that mothers hoped could be aborted and the child survived and they put into a locked room to die on its own. It's already happening. It's an indifferent mother. It's gruesome to think about. Israel was behaving herself like an illegitimate child, someone who didn't have a home, someone who didn't care about family. She was conducting herself as an ungrateful son. One of the first things that disappears when a heart begins to grow cold is a grateful spirit. She was conducting herself like a stubborn heifer. That may not mean a lot to many of you. I know what that's like. As a matter of fact, first thing that comes to my mind as I say that is, and I don't want to get too far off the track, but Brian was here last week, you know, from Uganda, and Shirley and I took opportunity to drive him up to Ben and Danielle's in River Falls, just outside of the Twin Cities, and take him to his dad's Ben's dad's place to see his farm. And I've always wanted to go up there and see his dairy operation. And we drove up and got out, and there was a couple of people that Brian had knew. He's only been gone 2 months from there, so some of the workers there still recognize him. And so we sat sort of on a porch and watched Ben and his twin brother try to get some cows in a loading chute to put them in a trailer to take to sale. And it was so fascinating how many times I've gone through what they went through. Oh, they were doing everything to get those cows in the chute. And they were doing everything to tear up, my dad used to say, tear up Ned. That means just tear things down. They actually broke down the corral that they were in. They backed through it and broke the metal bars out of the posts. They were having an awful time. And it took several times. And then when they finally got all but one in, that one decided she was going to get completely out. So she was outside the barn running around in the lawn. Stubborn. Unruly. I mean, even with cattle prods. That shock. They weren't having any of it. Israel was like that. Stubborn heifer. You old heifer, we used to say when we were on the farm. You old heifer. A silly dove. A silly dove. Did you know doves were silly? When God talked about we are to be wise as serpents, but harmless as doves. Just silly little creatures sometimes. She also conducted herself like a wild vine. This time of year, you can find that some of the colored leaves that are in the woods are from a wild grapevine. They turn first. And you'll see them grow up the side of a tree and actually canopy an oak tree and kill it by closing out the sun. A wild grapevine. When God looks at us, this is what he sees. So if you kind of blend those all together and try to get a character sketch out of those metaphors that God uses to describe Israel, here are the steps that a person goes through to get a heart that's hard toward God. I hope you don't find yourself in any of these. The first is discontentment. Discontentment. One of the first steps for a heart that's becoming hard toward God is a heart that's dissatisfied with God. Just discontent with him. Why have you done this to me, God? Why are you doing this? Why don't you remove this from me, God? You just are discontented toward him. The next step is disinterest in him. You turn to something other than God to make you feel better about how bad you feel. So you blame God for what he's not doing or is doing, and then you become disinterested in what he has to offer, so you look at something else to offer you relief. Some people turn to drugs. Some people turn to cosmetics. Some people turn to clothing. Some people turn to other people. Some people turn to possessions. Basically, there's just four places that people turn: power, popularity, possessions, and pleasure. That's where people turn. It's always away from God. It's always to something else that promises you you're going to feel better after you do it, and it never lives up to its billing. So you become disinterested. The next thing is you express displeasure. You actually become offended at God. You'll tolerate being around people who believe in God, but really it just kind of irritates you. It's kind of something you want to try to avoid. I just don't like being around those people. And finally, the last step is displacement. You actually place in your heart something you like better than God. He's displaced. These are the four steps that a person goes through. If you look at these metaphors that God uses, let's take the promiscuous wife. At some point, Gomer, who was married to Hosea, had to become discontent with him. He's just not enough. I was so saddened when I took in something that I needed fixed, and talking to a friend of mine who was going to fix it for me. He owned a business and where they fixed things, and asked him how he was doing, and he says, not too good. And he wasn't somebody who complained about his life. I said, well, what's going on? And we know each other well enough, I can ask, you know, what's going on. He says, yesterday, now listen to this, yesterday my wife came to me and said, get out, because you can't give me the retirement I want. You know, it almost made me cry. I could not believe it. How could someone do that? You know, we always hear of men being cads, but women do too. You know, one of my friends, when we were in our first church, we spent a lot of time with them, and I was on a fishing trip with Brother Lowell and Rod and Lloyd Nordenstrom. And we're in this little mom and pop, some people will call them a greasy spoon. You know, it's a good place to eat breakfast, but you're not sure what you're getting. But I don't want to go in the kitchen and look how clean it is, but the eggs are sure good. But anyway, I'm sitting there, and a woman walks up to the end of our table and says, hi, how you doing? And I looked up, and I'm doing fine, but I did not recognize her. And she put her hands on her hip. You know who I am. And now I'm under the gun. I'm supposed to know. And I haven't got a clue. I mean, I'm searching the archives. Nothing is coming to me. And so I thought, well, who's she with? And I looked over. I knew I didn't know that guy. And I said, I don't know who you are. And she names herself. You know, she's patting her foot by this time. She names herself. I said, and I couldn't say anything. I know my mouth was open. You know, I'm sure Brother Lowell sitting over there saw that shocked look on my face. I didn't know what to say. And I'm looking at him, and I'm looking back at her. And, you know, sometimes I don't keep a very good wall up when I'm talking. I should get things under control. But I said, where's, and I'm going to use Bill, where's Bill? You know, I mean, I just said it just like that, just where's, but I use his real name. But I'm still looking at the other guys. Where's Bill? And she says, oh, he's at catting around somewhere. It made me weep that these kind of things can happen. Discontentment. I want something else. There's a book, or at least a part of a book, called, not Gary Cooper's High Noon, but Alone at High Noon is the name of it. It's sort of play on that movie. And it has a chapter in there, The Incessant Pursuit of Elsewhere. Elsewhere is capitalized like it's a town, a city. And this guy is encouraging, the author is encouraging people, don't be looking elsewhere to get what you want. And here was one of the lines in his story. He says, if Einstein goes to elsewhere and walks down the street and walks up the step to a house and knocks on the door, who is going to answer the door in elsewhere except Einstein? So you can't run away from you. And often when we become discontent with where we are, it leads us to coldness of heart, a place we should never be. But that's what happens. And that happened to Gomer. Disinterest. Other men seem more interesting. Displeasure. There's got to be more to life than this. There has to be some fun out there somewhere. And then displacement. I'm going to be with somebody else. Until you have to pay the price for the choices that you make. Once the pay is demanded, you're looking for God. Help. Help me. Help me. Help me. This is the way it happens. We have a coldness of heart. And you say, that can't be. That can't be true in our culture. Yeah. I'm going to give you three words that are pertinent to our common conversation, where it's culturally or in churches, that will identify that people's hearts have grown cold. Here's what everybody I hear talking, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer or Trump or Beto or whoever, here's what they're, even in church, here's what they're talking about. I need to be affirmed. You need to affirm me. There's a self-centered attitude. You need to affirm me. I can be asked in public, in a checkout line at a gas station, does your church affirm people? I mean, people just expect you to answer that question because this is what they're thinking about. They're wanting to be affirmed. They're wanting to be entertained. Make me feel better about how badly I feel about my life and my circumstances. Entertain me. And they want us to be like a dog and pony show. Help, let us entertain you. And get our little canes and our hats out and do a little dance. And hopefully everybody will feel better. Everywhere you go, people want to be entertained. It shocked me this week to see someone interviewing a young man. And he looked to be about 10 years old, maybe 11, somewhere like that. I'm not real good with ages. And they were asking him questions. And he was standing there like this. That's what he was doing with his hand. Now, he didn't have anything in his hand. That's the way he was standing with his hand. And he's just standing like this. As the person was asking him questions, he's standing here, just moving around with his hand like that. Well, why is he doing that? You know, when I was his age, my hands were stuck in a position too, like this. They fit the pitchfork. But his hand fit what? His handheld device. Entertain me. We had occasion to take the little ones to one of my favorite spots. It's where I can get potatoes and gravy, peas, and beets. And when I finish that, I'm able to go back and get more potatoes and gravy. But then I get cottage cheese with it. Then I can go back and get more potatoes and gravy and a slice of cactus bread. It's a great place to go. So we're able to go there, and I indulged as if it was a feast day. And we're eating away. And I was hungry. Yeah, I'm hungry. What's for lunch, baby? I forget now why I was telling you that. Oh, entertained? Entertained. Oh, three adults. Three adults. Older than, well, not as old as me, but a man, his sister-in-law, and her husband. Each of them had their device out. And each of them were doing this number, and they were talking about what they were finding. So if they found something that was funny. I mean, the conversation was, what did I find? You tell me what you found. We'll laugh and go to the next one. So, well, whatever happened to conversation? Entertained. Third, excuse me. Excuse me. Don't ask me to change what I'm doing. Just excuse me for doing it. This is a person who has a cold heart toward God. Affirm me, entertain me, excuse me. They don't even want God to interrupt their life, let alone turn to Him and plead with Him for mercy. So many people are going to go to their grave, and a minute after they die, are going to be in a situation kneeling before God, wishing they could ask for mercy that they should have asked for 15 years earlier. You don't want to live with regret. It's a terrible place to live. And the best way to not have to live with regret is to find a place and get alone with God. And just as He tells through Hosea, take words to God. We don't pray a prayer here, because if you are honest about your relationship with Jesus Christ, I don't need to tell you what to say. You know what to say. Just tell Him. You talk to Him. I don't need to. You talk to Him and ask Him for mercy. Because if you don't, and you have to pay for your own sin, you can't get it done. I was in a conversation online with somebody who wanted our opinion on hell. And so I gave him a definition. I don't ever do this. Well, I did once at this time. And I wrote in there, I signed in and I wrote, and I said, here's what hell is. It's a perfect place for those who have eternity to work out their own sin. And I said that on purpose, because you're going to have eternity to deal with your own sin, because you haven't asked Jesus to deal with it for you. People think that hell is going to be this temporary place, that, oh, it's bad, I go there and then I'm done with it and I go on. And I go into some dreamland someplace. Hell is a place where God's vengeance is against you forever, because you cannot pay for your sin. And there's nobody else, because you rejected, who's pay it for you, because you rejected the only person who could pay for it and take away the penalty, which is Jesus Christ. If you haven't asked Him to be your Savior, then you're going to have to be your own Savior. And you won't make it. You can never be good enough. Please be careful and listen to what the Lord is offering us.